sir.
Mr. President, I wanted to ask you about accountability. You're a big believer in it. You've talked about it with regard to the public schools. But given the performance of Iraqi leaders, given your decision to commute the sentence of Louis Libby, you've also stood by the Attorney General recently. There have been a lot of questions about your commitment to accountability. And I'm wondering if you could give the American people some clear examples of how you've held people accountable during your presidency.
Louis Libby was held accountable. He was declared guilty by a jury, and he paid a high price for it. Al Gonzalez, implicit in your questions is that Al Gonzalez did something wrong. I haven't seen Congress say he's done anything wrong. As a matter of fact, I believe, David, we're watching a political, you know, a political exercise. I mean, this is a man who... He's testified. He sent thousands of papers up there. There's no proof of wrong. Why would I hold somebody accountable who has done nothing wrong? I mean, I think that's a typical Washington, D.C. assumption, not to be accusatory. I know you're a kind, open-minded fellow. But you suggested holding the Attorney General accountable for something he did wrong. And matter of fact, I would hope Congress would become more prone to deliver pieces of legislation that matter as opposed to being the investigative body. I mean, there have been over 600 different hearings, and yet they're struggling with getting appropriations bills to my desk.
Given the decision to commute the sentence of Libby, given the performance of Iraqi leaders, is it fair for people to ask questions about your commitment to accountability?
I would hope people would say that that I am deliberate in my decision making. I think about all aspects of the decisions I make, and I'm a fair person. Let's see. Mark Smith, a radio man.
Thank you very much, sir, for including our radio folks here.
Face for radio.
I wish I could say that was the first time you told me that, sir.
First time I did it to a national audience, though.
Actually, my wife the last time.
Stretch. Big stretch.
Oh, sorry. Mr. President. I know you said there'll be a time for politics, but you've also said you wanted to change the tone of Washington. Howard Dean recently seemed to muse aloud whether you had advanced knowledge of 9/11. Do you agree or disagree with the RNC that this kind of rhetoric borders on political hate speech?
Yeah. Look, there's time for politics, and it's time for politics, and it's an absurd insinuation.
In that case, sir, can I follow up on something unrelated?
Over the past few years, to the traditional sounds of an English summer, the drone of lawnmowers, the smack of leather on willow, has been added a new noise.
What were the skies like when you were young?
They went on forever. We lived in Arizona, and the skies always had little fluffy clouds in them, and they were long and clear, and there were lots of stars at night. And when it would rain, they were beautiful, the most beautiful skies, as a matter of fact. The sunsets were purple and red and yellow and on fire. The clouds would catch the colors everywhere. That's neat, because I used to look at them all the time when I was little. You don't see that. the skies always had little fluffy clouds in them, and they were long and clear, and there were lots of stars at night. And when it would rain, it would all turn. They were beautiful, the most beautiful skies, as a matter of fact. The sunsets were purple and red and yellow and on fire, and the clouds would catch the colors everywhere. That's it, me, because I used to look at them all the time. You don't see that. You might still see them in the desert.
Ask you another area, and then we can take a break. You know, I live about an hour's drive from Canada, and go up there often. And in Vermont, we tend to get a lot of Canadian news, just radio and so on. But something that made the news here in the United States was the question of Maharara, M-A-H-E-R. A-R-A-R, in case I mispronounce it. He's a Canadian citizen. He was returning home from a vacation. Plane stops at JFK in New York and continues on to Canada. He was detained by federal agents at JFK Airport 2002 on suspicion of ties to terrorism. He was deported to Syria. Wasn't sent on the couple hundred miles to Canada, turned over to the Canadian authorities, but he's sent thousands of miles away to Syria. He's held for 10 months. The Canadian Commission later found that there was no evidence to support he had any terrorist connection or posed any threat, but that he was tortured in Syria. He was held in abhorrent conditions there. And those sending him back must have known he was going to be tortured. The Canadian government has apologized for its part in this debacle. In fact, the head of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police actually resigned over it. The country is prepared to compensate him for it. This country has not said anything at all that we made any mistake or had any apology. Press accounts indicate the Justice Department approved his deportation to Syria. I've not heard anything clear from the Justice Department about their role in this affair. And I understand he remains on the United States terrorist watch list, so he couldn't come 50 miles or 75 miles or whatever south into the United States without fear of being picked up again, sent back to Syria. Why is he on a government watch list if he's been found completely innocent by this Canadian commission, which actually had information from us?
Senator, I've got some very definite views about this particular case.
As you know,
we are in litigation. What I want to do is, in hopefully in the next few days, I'm happy to sit down with you and Senator Spector and give you more information. In fact, we may be able to publicly say more about this shortly. I'm just not at liberty at this time.
Let me ask you this. Why aren't you at liberty? I don't understand that. It's not a matter of executive privilege.
No, sir, again.
I'm not
suggesting that I will not be able to answer your questions. I'm just suggesting I can't do it. I can't do it today.
Why?
I'm not. We're, there is not a position. I can't represent the position of the executive branch on this particular issue, but I think in a relatively short period of time, there's more information that I should be able to share with you, and hopefully that we can share publicly.
Well, why was he sent to Syria instead of Canada?
Well, again, Senator, I'd be happy to answer these questions. I'm aware of the list of questions you and Senator Chairman Biden have submitted with respect to this particular case. I think we can say a lot more about it if you just simply give me some additional time.
Can you tell me whether you took steps to ensure that he wouldn't be tortured? Or he was.
I believe that piece of information is public. There were steps. I think General Ashcroft confirmed this publicly, is that there were assurances sought that he would not be tortured from Syria. But again,
Attorney General, I'm sorry. I don't mean treat this lightly. We knew damn well if he went to Canada, he wouldn't be tortured. He'd be held. He'd be investigated. We also knew damn well if he went to Syria, he'd be tortured. And it's beneath the dignity of this country, a country that has always been a beacon of human rights, to send somebody to another country to be tortured. You know, and I know, that has happened a number of times in the past 5 years by this country. It is a black mark on us. It has brought about the condemnation of some of our closest and best allies. They have made those comments both publicly and privately to the President of the United States and others. And it is easy for us to sit here comfortably in this room knowing that we're not going to be sent off to another country to be tortured, to treat it as though, well, Attorney General Ashcroft said, we got assurances. Those assurances from a country that we also say now, oh, we can't talk to them because we can't take their word for anything.
Well, Senator,
I'm somewhat upset.
Yes, sir, I can tell. But before you get more upset, perhaps you should wait to receive the briefing.
How long?
I'm hoping that we can get to the information next week.
Well, Attorney General, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll meet you halfway on this. I'll wait next week for that briefing. If we don't get it, I guarantee you there'll be another hearing on this issue. Canadians have been our closest allies, longest unguarded frontier in the world. They're justifiably upset. They're wondering what's happened to us. They're wondering what's happened to us. Now, you know and I know we're a country with a great, great tradition of protecting people's individual liberties and rights. You take an oath of office to do that. I take an oath of office to do that. I believe in my basic core nature in that. My grandparents, when they immigrated to this country, believed that. Let us not create more terrorism around the world by telling the world that we cannot keep up to our basic standards and beliefs. So I'll wait a week. I'll wait a week. But I won't wait more than a week for that briefing. We'll stand in recess unless you want to say something further.
Only, Mr. Chairman, that we understand what our legal obligations are with respect to when someone is either removed, extradited, or rendered to another country. We understand what our obligations are under the Convention Against Torture, and we do take the steps to ensure that those obligations are being met. I look forward to being able to provide the briefing that you're requesting.
Thank you. We'll stand in recess at 2 o'clock.
How about the death penalty case? I wrote you about this. Had a man who was convicted of murder. Victim's body was never recovered. There was no forensic evidence directly linking the defendant to the victim's death. The U.S. attorney, a man named Paul Charlton, contacted your office and said, I don't think this is a proper case for the death penalty. Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty had a conversation with Mr. Charlton and had a conversation with you, and then McNulty's chief of staff, Mike Elston, called Charlton, and this is Charlton's testimony. Elston indicated that McNulty had spoken to the Attorney General and that McNulty wanted me to be aware of two things. First, that McNulty had spent a significant amount of time on this issue with the Attorney General, perhaps as much as 5 or 10 minutes. Is that accurate? Factually, will you answer a question as to a fact as to whether You talked to McNulty about this case for as much as 5 or 10 minutes?
I have no specific recollection as to this particular case, but I can tell you, we have a very detailed process where hours are spent by lawyers, including the U.S. Attorney, our Capital Case Review Unit, who then made recommendations
to the Deputy Attorney General. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in an answer to my question. If you don't know, if you don't remember...
Wait a minute.
I'm not finished asking you the question. If you don't know or you don't remember what happened when you stood on a decision to have a man executed, that's what you're saying.
I have no specific recollection about the amount of time that I talked with Paul McNulty on this particular issue.
Well, would you disagree with McNulty that it was 5 to 10 minutes?
I can't agree with that if I don't recall, Senator.
Okay, you can't agree with it. I didn't ask you that. I asked you if you disagreed with it.
I can't agree or disagree with it.
Would you say that 5 to 10 minutes would be a, quote, significant amount of time for you to spend on a case involving the death penalty?
It would depend on the circumstances of the case and the recommendations coming up and the facts. That those would all dictate how much time I would spend personally on a particular case. Because we have a very extensive review process within the department where hours are spent analyzing what is the appropriate course of action for the Department
of
Justice.
Well, Mr. Attorney General, I'm not totally unfamiliar with this sort of thing. When I was District Attorney of Philadelphia, I had 500 homicides a year. I didn't allow any assistant to ask for the death penalty that I hadn't personally approved. And when I asked for the death penalty, I remembered the case.
Hello, everybody. Well, as you probably know, the House Judiciary Committee has just voted along partisan lines to have a criminal contempt of Congress referral against the White House legal counsel and the White House chief of staff. In our view, this is pathetic. What's interesting is that there have been all these hearings on the Attorney General, and yet nobody's really laid a glove on him. What you do is you have complaints, but there is yet to be any specific allegation. Again, look at all the pages here. Look at all the hearings. It is as if they keep throwing mud against the wall, hoping something's going to stick. Frankly, if you have something solid and you think you do it, invite the people up, ask the questions. Everybody's been made available. You have not been denied a shred of information. I've yet to hear anybody say any piece of information that they've been denied. Instead, this looks like an attempt to provoke something that falls more into the area of political theater.
If there is something in question, granted it might have been 400 investigations, but if there was something in question, isn't that the people's
business? Well, that's a very good question. But what if there isn't anything in question? And somebody's going on a... April, at this point, we have hundreds of hearings that have produced bupkis.
You said you've made everybody available and everything available when it comes to the intelligence, but you haven't made everybody available. You've made them available if they go without the oath, if they go without the transcript, and if they go in private. But you haven't even made the documents available. You've only made the documents available that aren't the documents that they want. You won't make the documents available that they do want.
Because the documents they do want violate executive privilege. You're absolutely right. Those that violate the privilege, we're not going to share with them. It has had plenty of opportunities to review documents, and as you know, there have been a number of cases where people were called up to the Hill and people say, wow, this is going to be the big one. And it turns out nothing. There is no fact that they would not have access to, and furthermore, there is no situation under which somebody testifying before members of Congress would not be compelled to tell the truth. If there was no transcript, they could ask the same question 48 times. They could tell them to slow down and write it on the wall in crayon if they so decided. But the fact is that you would have the opportunity to get a full hearing of what everybody said. You could vet it. You could cross-reference it against other statements. You could do a completely full investigation. And what's being deprived is a little bit of political theater. What we've been trying to do is to create a little air of dignity in this town.
The transcript seems to be the one area in which you could all agree. It seems to be one thing that is frankly just silly. Everybody knows that the lack of a transcript is something.
You know what's silly, Victoria, is after we have made all these offers, Congress doesn't step forward with anything. That's silly.
You said the Democrats seem to want confrontation. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. They say the same thing about the White House, of course.
But wait a minute. I cannot let them get away with that. We've talked about a whole series of things where we have reached out and we have had a series of escalating proffers in terms of making people and information available. You simply cannot say that that is stubbornness on the part of the White House when we have made available all this documents, when we've made the people available, and the Congress itself has said, nope, we're just going to push this story to confrontation. I think that the attitudes and approaches are significantly different. Proceed. But I'll tell you what has happened is that there has been no demonstration that they've been willing to take up the offer, to get access to all the facts. We have made it possible for them to proceed down the road to gather information and to try to assess the situation, and they've just basically rebuffed it.
What do you mean when you say that nobody's really laid a glove on Gonzales? Isn't the president troubled by senators questioning his truthfulness and by Specter saying that he doesn't think he has any credibility?
What's happened on a number of occasions is that people have hauled him up and there have been insinuations, and yet in the end, what is the specific charge? What is the specific charge of malfeasance?
Well, the
president stands. The president is bothered sometimes by the tone of debate in Washington. He understands it can be bruising. He stands by the attorney general.
What were the skies like when you were young?
That's a stupid question. I don't know. Can't remember. I don't know. Can't remember. I don't know. Can't remember. It's a long time ago.
What were the skies like when you were young?
Grey, monotonous. Grey, you know, like they are now. I mean, they seem to go on like a bit and then it changes sometimes. I mean, I used to live in Watford, it's a very dull place. But, you know, they were grey, cloudy. I mean, you still see skies like that all the time, you know, just when the weather's bad, just look up and bad sky, that's how it is, you know. I mean, sky's not that important, really, in the long term. But basically, it was sort of grey, monotonous. It used to rain a lot, as it does now. It's a very dull place. I mean, you still see skies like that all the time, in all over the place, wherever you are, there's grey skies, grey, monotonous.
So what were the skies like when you were young?
I've told you, they were grey and monotonous and dull, right? It was just, I mean, the sun shone sometimes, but I don't remember that so much. It was mainly grey and grey and dull.
What were the skies like when you were young?
You're beginning to get on my nerves with your persistent question, right? Told you, sky's dull, grey, and not important, right? The sky doesn't matter, it's the issues.
But what were the skies like when you were young?
I think I'll have to curtail this interview, mate, if you don't like, come up with some better questions. Right, last time, right, grey. The skies were grey, basically, and dull, and that's it, all right? Grey. Grey, grey.
But what were the skies like when you
That's
were young?
That's it! Oh!
Do you want Attorney General Gonzales to keep fighting to keep his job?
I do. I'm a big fan of Al's.
Does he need to clarify his testimony?
I'm not going to get into the specifics of it. I think Al's done a good job under difficult circumstances that the... debate between he and the Senate, something they're going to have to resolve, but I think he has testified truthfully.
How do you answer even those Republicans like Senator Specter and Congressman Shays, who say that in their view the Attorney General's credibility has been damaged?
Well, I don't agree with them.
Can he remain Attorney General if the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Pat Leahy, says point blank he doesn't trust the Attorney General?
Well, I've had my differences with Pat Leahy. I think the key is whether or not he has the confidence of the president, and he clearly does.
Maybe hundreds of miles away, you've got problems in terms of the extent of which you can use public funds to go in and clean refuse and debris off private property. And so those kinds of issues need to get resolved, and those issues are being worked by FEMA as well as by state officials. So there are problems like that that need to be sorted out. You've got, as I was talking to the mayor, in those areas, one of the things you've got to address, you've got to figure out what to do with all of the debris.
Are you getting a lot of that, Mr. Vice President?
And it's the first time I've heard it. He's a friend of John, or of, never mind.
Do you think that the U.S. or U.N. forces should have moved into Baghdad?
No.
Why not?
Because if we'd gone to Baghdad, we would have been all alone. There wouldn't have been anybody else with us. It would have been a U.S. occupation of Iraq. None of the Arab forces that were willing to fight with us in Kuwait were willing to invade Iraq. Once you got to Iraq and took it over and took down Saddam Hussein's government, then what are you going to put in its place? That's a very volatile part of the world, and if you take down the central government in Iraq, you can easily end up seeing pieces of Iraq fly off. Part of it the Syrians would like to have to the west. Part of eastern Iraq the Iranians would like to claim, fought over for 8 years. In the north, you've got the Kurds, and if the Kurds spin loose and join with the Kurds in Turkey, then you've threatened the territorial integrity of Turkey. It's a quagmire if you go that far and try to take over Iraq. The other thing was casualties. Everyone was impressed with the fact that we were able to do our job with as few casualties as we had. But for the 146 Americans killed in action and for their families, it wasn't a cheap war. And the question for the president in terms of whether or not we went on to Baghdad and took additional casualties in an effort to get Saddam Hussein was how many additional dead Americans is Saddam worth? And our judgment was not very many, and I think we got it right.
Shield on the freeway. Waiting, but there's no ship sailing. Groucho with his movies trailing, stands alone with his punchline failing. Ku Klux Klan serve hot soul food, and the band plays In the Mood. The cheerleader waves her cyanide wand, there's a smell of peach blossom and bitter almond. Carl Chessman sniffs the air and leads the parade. He knows, innocent, you can bottle all you made. There's Howard Hughes in blue suede shoes, smiling at the majorette smoking Winston cigarettes. And as the song and dance begins, the children play at home with needles, needles and pins.
Of course, I do want to salute those of you who are the contributors, those of you who did make these dinners a success across the nation.
Down in the basement of party headquarters is the operation aimed at embarrassing pundits who say Nixon doesn't appeal to youth. The people in charge here are from the 18 to 21-year-old bracket. The campaign they are running is aggressive, colorful, and articulate.
First of all, voter registration is probably the most important function that we are undertaking now. We're also seeking to train college students to run voter registration drives and to work towards involving young people in campaigns. You can't get a 35-year-old to teach the Republican Party how to get to young people. We just can't rely upon it. Young people have got to reach other young people, and that's what we're seeking to do.
I don't know, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not what you call introspective, but I do have fears. I have concerns. I have worries. I have a family. I think about the future. I think about the position not only of myself but this great country and the world today.
Yes.
And when you see the people who are controlling the strings, who are actually running and making policy, it makes you wonder. And sometimes it makes you wince. It makes you cry. It makes you remorseful. Yes, it can even make you feel ashamed. So we've put together tonight a segment called Why the World Hates Us, featuring presidential advisor Karl Rove.
Yes.
Presidential advisor Karl Rove.
You know, I'm sure.
The segment is Why the World Hates Us.
He will do it, or without fail. Because he's shooting quail. This man will never stop. Look at him jumping up and down around. It's a hop.
MC Rove.
That's not right. That's not right. I don't know that I can prove it, but I have a very strong feeling that that's unconstitutional. I'm going to look into it. But I'm telling you, one way or the other, that's not right.
Here's a fantastic story about Thanksgiving of 2004 in the New York Times Magazine. About 2 weeks before the election, Ken Melman, the brilliant manager of our effort in 2004, called me up. He said, the New York Times just called me, and they want to put a reporter inside our Get Out the Vote operation in Ohio. They promised not to write anything about it until after the election, and they've already got somebody who's covering the Democrats, and what do you think we ought to do? And I said, I think we've got better things to do than to babysit some snot-nosed reporter from the New York Times. It's not that my feelings were hurt that they'd gone to the Democrats first, and the Democrats had already said yes and had somebody inside the headquarters. That wasn't a sign of bias on the part of the New York Times. Of course not. Nor did I have any distrust of the fact that they said they wouldn't write until after the election. I'm sure they could. But they did have somebody inside the Democrat campaign. His name was Matt Bye, and he ended up writing a story about the Democrats since we had better things to do. And it's a delicious story. The story opens up. It's a lengthy, delicious story. The article opens up, it's early in the morning, and it's in Columbus, and they're getting messages from all around the state. the buses and vans are ready to deliver people to the polls, and they're out there, and everything's humming, and they've been flying around the state the last few days in a jet provided by a wealthy personal injury trial lawyer, and they're getting things ready to go, and it's, boy, it's helping. And then they're all during the morning, they're getting phone calls, and all the Democrats are turning out to vote. The Republican turnout is low, and it's really great. They got the biggest, they've hired more people through temporary agencies, and they got more people on the union payrolls that are working for them than they could ever imagine, and they're getting the vote. And about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they got a little bit of nervous energy, so they get in the car and they drive out to the suburban Republican precinct in Dublin, going to the biggest Republican precinct they can find to see how the Republicans are doing. They walk in, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and no one is there. And Andy Grand, until they go over and look at the little piece of paper posted on the wall that shows how many people in this overwhelmingly Republican precinct had turned out to vote. And it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and they got 4 hours more before the polls close, and 72% of the people have already voted, and they say, oh, no. The rest of the story is how they spiral into the ground. My favorite moment is when they start throwing things at the television sets. It seems to me to be like a terrible waste of a quality consumer electronics product. The reason we beat them is because we had more volunteers who cared with the passion that only a volunteer can care about talking to friends and neighbors about their candidate and getting them out to vote. And next year, that's what we need in North Carolina. For our president, for our Senate, for our candidate for governor, for our candidate for Congress. And you're it. It's entirely possible for you to do that. It's entirely possible for you to shape the outcome of this contest by what you do in the months between now and November 2008. So thanks for your vital role in ensuring our success. Thanks for working hard to carry this day for George W. Bush.
Frustrate you, I know you said earlier, just ignore the criticism, but frustrate you with all the attacks on him as brain dead or a frat boy, that you're the brain and this sort of thing, or do you again shelve that and just to go about your day?
Well, I shelve that, but I have to admit I'm amused by it because, you know, this is one of the best read people I've ever met. This is a Harvard MBA. This is a Yale undergraduate whose major was history and whose passion is history. And the people, many times the people that I see criticizing him are, you know, sort of elite, effete snobs who, you know, can't hold a candle to this guy. What they don't like about him is that he has common sense, that he is middle America.
He outsmarts him.
Yeah, and look, in a way, you know, they misunderestimate him, and he likes that. And in fact, I think to some degree he cultivates that because, you know, it doesn't matter to him if you know somebody on the, you know, Upper East Side is, you know, putting their nose in the air about him. You know, he is who he is, and he's comfortable in his own skin, and he's not going to change just to, you know, win popularity with, you know, with the elites.
You said that he's a voracious reader. Tell Pete, you and he have a reading contest.
We do. It happened by accident. We generally gossip on Sundays, and the Sunday before New Year's of last year, 2006, we were gossiping, and I could hear Laura in the background, and the president said to me, you know, do you have any good New Year's resolutions? I've got to figure out a good New Year's resolution. And I said, I'm a big reader. When I moved to Washington, we brought 158 cartons of books, and I love to read. It's a great way to relax and a great way to learn. But I said, well, yeah, my object in 2006 is to read a book a week. My object is to do 52 books in the year. And he said, great, you know, sort of dismissed it and went on. Well, about the 2nd or 3rd of January, we're in the Oval Office waiting for the vice president and a couple of others to straggle into a meeting, and he looked at me and said, I'm on my second, where are you? And so we went off to the races on a book contest, and we kept track of books, and I leaped to an early lead, and he began a refrain which he's used a lot, which is that he was in second place because he was the leader of the free world and had a real job to do, which I, you know, sorts, I mean, look, I'm that's competitive, but I mean, come on, please. But no, we've had a great, it's been a great experience the last year and a half. We've been trading book suggestions back and forth.
How many books have you guys read?
I beat him last year, 110-94, and I'm ahead this year. I won't give you the total because it would crush you. But I mean, it's and again, he keeps saying, "Look, I'm the leader of the free world," but I won the first year. In fact, It got so it was very funny.
He's not reading little pamphlets.
No.
President Bush today announced the resignation of his top political aide, Karl Rove, effective at the end of August. The two spoke briefly with reporters just before the president headed to his ranch in Crawford, Texas. This is about 5 minutes.
Karl Rove is moving on down the road. I've been talking to Karl for a while about his desire to spend more time with Darby and Andrew. This is a family that's made enormous sacrifices, not only for our beloved state of Texas, but for a country we both love. We've been friends for a long time, and we're still going to be friends. I would call Karl Rove a dear friend. We've known each other as youngsters interested in serving our state. We worked together so we could be in a position to serve this country. And so I thank my friend. I'll be on the road behind you here in a little bit. I thank Darby and I thank Karl for making a tremendous sacrifice. And I wish you all the very best.
Today I submitted my resignation as Deputy Chief of Staff and Senior Advisor effective the end of the month. Mr. President, I'm grateful for the opportunity you gave me to serve our nation and you. I'm grateful for being able to work with the extraordinary men and women that you've drawn into this administration. And I'm grateful to have been a witness to history. It has been the joy and the honor of a lifetime. I've seen a man of far-sighted courage put America on a war footing and protect us against a brutal enemy in a dangerous conflict that will shape this new century. I've seen a leader respond to an economy weakened by recession, corporate scandal, and terrorist attacks by taking decisive action to strengthen the economy and create jobs. I've seen a reformer who challenged his administration, the Congress, and the country to make bold changes to important institutions in great need of repair. Mr. President, the world's turned many times since our journey began. We've been at this a long time. It was over 14 years ago that you began your run for governor, and over 10 years ago that we started thinking and planning about a possible run for the presidency. And it's been an exhilarating and eventful time. Through it all, you've remained the same man. Your integrity, character, and decency have remained unchanged and inspiring. Through all those years, I've asked a lot of my family, and they've given all I've asked and more. And now it seems the right time to start thinking about the next chapter in our family's life. It's not been an easy decision, as you know from our discussions that started last summer. It always seemed there was a better time to leave somewhere out there in the future. But now is the time. I will miss, deeply miss my work here, my colleagues, and the opportunity to serve you and our nation, Mr. President. But I look forward to continuing our friendship of 34 years, to being your fierce and committed advocate on the outside, and to the next journey we might make together. At month's end, I will join those whom you meet in your travels, the ordinary Americans who tell you they're praying for you. Like them, I will ask for God's continued gifts of strength and wisdom for you and your work, your vital work for our country and the world, and for the Almighty's continued blessing of our great country. Thank you again for this extraordinary opportunity.
Show notes at lies.com. I'm John Callender. Thanks for listening.
These walls have
have eyes, rows of photographs of faces like mine. Who do you become without knowing where we start it from? It's true, I'm missing you, and I stand alone inside your room. Everything that you made by hand, everything that you know by heart, I'll try to connect all the pieces you made. I will carry it on, let you forget. I remember the years when your mind was still clear, all the flickering lights that filled up this side. It hangs the favorite dress, good books that you read are in pieces now, the pages are shredded. Everything that you made by everything that you know by heart, I will try to collect all the pieces you've left. I will carry it on and let you forget. I'll remember the years when your mind was still clear, all the laughter and light up this silent to connect.